From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
On the panel this week, Richard Lottendress, Washington correspondent for TVA Nouvelle, and Dan Ravid, national correspondent for Israeli-based I-24 News. Our moderator is White House correspondent for West Wing Reports, Paul Brandis.
Hello, thank you for joining us, and here are the issues. President Trump has ordered an American withdrawal from Syria, and not coincidentally, his defense secretary said he is resigning. Also, the threat of a U.S. government shutdown, criminal justice reform, and some brief thoughts as 2018 winds down. Well, let's start with Syria. President Trump said this week that he will bring U.S. troops home from that war-torn country, move that seems to have caught just about everybody off guard. Dan Ravid, good to see you. You have been spent a big part of your career in that part of the world. You know it quite well. Tell us what this is all about.
Well, President Trump declared victory over ISIS, known in the region, of course, as Daesh. And he says that the United States was in Syria with about 2,000 troops, almost all special forces troops, purely to fight against ISIS. And now that that is done, they should come home. President Trump made clear in several follow-up messages, including on Twitter and especially on Twitter, that he thought that would be popular, that certainly the Republicans should like that, should agree with him. Mission accomplished. Let's save some money. Let's bring those Americans back home, announcing this just before Christmas. So I think the president's been quite surprised that there's so much criticism, and not just Democrats. His party, the Republicans, have been condemning this decision as well, and especially the lack of consultation. And that's what's led, as you mentioned, Paul, to Defense Secretary Jim Mattis resigning. He wasn't listened to. Apparently, he had urged President Trump not to pull out of Syria, that it's too soon. ISIS isn't defeated, and the U.S. still should have some position in that very complicated situation. Syria, since the civil war began in 2011, the U.S. is there with some leverage, fighting alongside Kurds, helping Kurdish people, and now the U.S. won't be there at all. A lot of people are really wondering about this.
Well, the president's contention that ISIS has been defeated, I mean, the Pentagon itself, I think back in August or September, issued a report saying that there are still something like 14,000 ISIS fighters still there, about an equivalent number, 14 or 15,000 next door in Iraq. 14,000 fighters. That doesn't sound, Richard, like they've ISIS has been crushed, as the president says.
It does not. The famous caliphate is definitely over, but the soldiers, the fighters themselves are all over the place, still all around Syria and definitely in Iraq too. And even the French army was taken by surprise by this decision, and they're fighting also ISIS on the ground. What is also surprising for observers and people who have been following this closely is the way the American soldiers have been with the Kurdish on the ground. The fights were done by the Kurdish fighters, who are considered as courageous, as sacrificing a lot to fight the extremists, but also secure an area for themselves in Syria for their population. And now the way the entire withdrawal seems to be unfolding is that we're going to let them on their own, not so much fighting ISIS, but then fighting the Turks on the other side of the border. And President Erdogan was very clear when he expressed his intention of going after them. Now that the American soldiers are not going to be there to support, to be with the Kurds on the ground, but also to stop Turks from crossing the border and fight the Kurds who are perceived as supporters of the separatist movement on the Turkish side of the border. Well, all this together gives the impression that being an ally of the United States on the ground in a major battle is not something you can count on for a long term afterwards.
And speaking of Erdogan, it's believed that the president's decision to pull these troops out came after a phone call with him. Now, Dan, on this subject, it's interesting that earlier in the week, the principal U.S. representative to Syria said that America is going to stay the course and he outlined three strategic objectives. We talked about crushing ISIS, but there were two other objectives also. One was containing Iran, and the other was coming up with some kind of political solution for that war-torn country. Those two things certainly have not been done.
Well, Paul, if the U.S. pulls out, then the United States won't have much of a voice in whatever political process will emerge. And ending this Syrian civil war, apparently with President Bashar Assad still in power in the capital, Damascus, what happens in the rest of the country? And what are U.S. interests? It's not oil. Syria's not a rich country. It's not that. It's preventing a return of ISIS or al-Qaeda. So experts in America on the subject of terrorism say the problem is, what if that becomes again an area of terrorist training bases? What if that becomes an area where people are plotting attacks in Britain and in France and in Belgium and then eventually the United States? President Trump has really decided that others should fight that fight. Again, on Twitter, he said that ISIS is also the enemy of Russia and Turkey. Let them do the fighting. Others have pointed out that the president of the United States is now giving that territory, in effect, to Russia, Iran, and Turkey. Turkey is a member of the NATO alliance, might be our friend. It certainly has its own goals. But Russia and Iran, again, a lot of shock. And I don't want to spend this whole time on the Voice of America, you know, lambasting the president of the United States. He's entitled to his decision. And all in all, whether it's on world politics or politics here in the U.S., he thinks the best thing to do is not get bogged down in another Afghanistan or Iraq. That's the way he sees it, and so he wants out.
Now, briefly, what does this mean for the Israelis? We know that Russian President Putin praised the move in his year-end news conference this week. What does it mean for the Israelis? What does it mean for Iran?
I'd say that Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu didn't hide the fact that he's concerned at the American move. He says he was told by President Trump in advance and that they discussed how the U.S. and Israel together can still oppose Iran and its ambitions. What Netanyahu was telling the Israeli people is, we're okay, we've got a strong military, so don't worry much. But certainly Israel and other pro-American countries and governments, Egypt, for instance, they would want the U.S. to still be strong in the region. But again, President Trump has always emphasized, even as a candidate in 2016, America first. Let's spend the money in the United States, not overseas. He thinks that the adventures in the Middle East have cost America at least $4 trillion, thousands of people dead, and he said it's gotten us nothing.
And on that note, Richard, this America First thing, we've also learned that the president wants to cut in half the American presence in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. And it's part of, to follow what Dan was saying, engagements, promises he made during the campaign. That was a major one. He repeated it, and his crowds, we saw this over all over the place, his crowds were cheering loudly when he was saying, let's bring our soldiers back home. So it's in the spirit of what he said during the campaign. And in the case of Afghanistan, and Syria, the same way. It's hard, however, to figure out a coherent strategy or perspective on all this, because in Syria, we hear so much constantly about the danger that Iran is being for the entire region. And now we're abandoning Syria to Russia and Iran. So it's hard to say now we've contained Iran. Now, the same thing in Afghanistan. The argument for a long time has been we have to find a way to make the Afghan forces, the army and the police stronger in order to be able to fight the Taliban and the Islamists on both sides. We have absolutely, and on the contrary, no proof that they have made any improvement in any way in fighting those extremists. On an American perspective, it's, and in thinking America first, it's probably the normal thing to do to bring back the soldiers. But if you want to be coherent in your way of describing the danger all over the place, it doesn't correspond to what we've been told for so long.
I know we have listeners in that part of the world, and they may wonder, if the U.S. starts withdrawing troops from Afghanistan, does the U.S. favor talks with the Taliban? Or is the U.S. in effect suggesting that the Taliban can bide its time and take over some of the cities in Afghanistan and we could live with that? And that's, again, where a lot of experts on terrorism are concerned that parts of Afghanistan could again become terrorist training bases. So we wonder if President Trump's looking to the next stage or just the immediate political payoff now in the U.S.
Moving on from Syria, sort of as a derivative of this, President Trump's defense secretary this week, James Mattis, had a meeting with the president in the Oval Office. He said he disagreed with this Syria pullout decision. They've had disagreements over a whole bunch of things, and Mattis said that he will leave. And he wrote a letter to the president that was not exactly complimentary, Dan.
But for a long time, maybe you'll agree, Paul, we haven't had a resignation like this. First, of course, it is caused immediately by the decision to pull out of Syria. Mattis disagreed with that. But his two-page letter that he did not have to write has this retired Marine Corps general, Mattis, writing about his own views on treating allies with respect and also being clear-eyed about malign actors, right, malignant forces, and strategic competitors. He mentioned Russia and China. So he's suggesting that President Trump has been not loyal to America's allies and has been too soft toward competitors and foes like Russia and China. So I think Mattis, in subtle language, but I think everyone in Washington is understanding it, is pointing out that President Trump is different. And Mattis wrote, "We must do everything possible to advance an international order that's conducive to our security, prosperity, and values, strengthened by the solidarity of our alliances," suggesting that President Trump has walked away from key alliances. So Mattis has now emerged as someone who has been opposed to Trumpism, even as Mattis has been Trump's defense secretary. Now we know the truth. Mattis will still be defense secretary through February, but I think now we realize that he never was a loyal Trumpist anyway.
And Richard, the general has been described, along with some other people, when President Trump came in, he surrounded himself with generals. There was Mr. McMaster, the security advisor, and John Kelly, who is at Homeland Security.
And Kelly's leaving next week.
Outgoing chief of staff next week. But all these generals are now gone, and some people think, well, gosh, what they've been called sort of the guardrails for this administration to keep the president, if you will, from veering off the road. That's what some people say. What, any truth to that?
Well, these generals, just like the other ones who were not in the military but were perceived as and described as the adults in the room, Gary Cohen for the economy, Rex Tillerson at the State Department, we can be critical, but he was a major stable presence. These people are gone, and the interesting thing is that who are replacing these people? The president has lost. For instance, he losing John Kelly as chief of staff and naming Mick Mulvaney, he has to go into the people who are already part of his team. The same thing with Heather Nauert at the State Department to replace Nikki Haley at the UN. Who wants to work with him?
All right. More are going to be talking about this in the weeks to come, I'm sure. Let's pause for a short break. More issues in the news in just a moment.
Issues in the News is coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, go ahead and check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel, Richard Lattendresse, Washington correspondent for TVA Nouvelle, and Dan Raviv, national correspondent for Israeli-based I-24 News. Our moderator is White House correspondent for West Wing Reports, Paul Brandis.
Welcome back. In addition to all the other things that we've been talking about, Syria, the departure of the Pentagon chief, there's this other little matter here in Washington called a government shutdown. Now, this week, you know, the Democrats and the Republicans have gone back and forth. I mean, every day, Dan, the story has changed here. The president will support a shutdown. He doesn't want to shut down. Congress goes back and forth. It's just hard to keep track of it.
It is mind spinning. And we're talking about part of the United States government shutting down, running out of money. The spending authority from Congress has to be renewed. And there isn't a budget for a full fiscal year. So often there are these little bandages that are put over the gaps in funding. So there had been a deadline on December 7th that there'd have to be funding or the government would shut down. But both Democrats and Republicans agreed, all right, we'll approve 2 weeks of spending. So we had till December 21st. President Trump said, I'm not going to agree to anything unless it includes $5 billion toward building a wall on the border with Mexico to keep America safe, to keep out unwanted migrants, to keep out terrorists, to keep out drugs. And he thought this is the time to push for his wall. The Democrats said, you're not going to get that, not $5 billion, maybe about $1.6 billion, but reluctantly. And this past week has just been a drama from day to day. Clearly, there had been an agreement that even the White House was happy with to delay the whole thing again till February 8th, to just keep the spending authority going and keep talking about the wall on the Mexico border. But the president pulled out of that deal. As a matter of fact, the United States Senate passed that deal, right? Put it off till February 8th. And so we expected the House of Representatives to approve that and pass the same thing. But President Trump declared, no, I'm not going for that. I absolutely want the $5 billion. So instead, the House of Representatives passed a measure that includes more than $5 billion for a wall on the Mexico border. The Democrats in the minority can block it in the United States Senate. And there, you know, we led to another showdown. The Senate would have to act against a midnight deadline. What a drama.
The thing that people don't seem to remember about this wall, as he originally envisioned it during his campaign, he called it his big, beautiful wall. But the problem is the cost for this wall, again, as he envisioned it, something like at least $20 billion. Now, the quibbling here is over a tiny fraction of even that. So that suggests that Trump's original proposal, again, for this big, beautiful wall, that's not going to happen. I mean, it's halfway through his term here. Even a tiny fraction of the money isn't there. So this wall, they may actually never get built.
You know, if the Republicans had held both the Senate and the House in the November elections, even then, I don't think the president would get all the money because there were Republicans who considered the wall idea a waste of money. Democrats are certainly against it. They claim that the wall is a racist idea, that it shows America fears and doesn't want foreigners and people from Latin America. So Democrats stand against that, absolutely. And the Democrats, of course, take the majority in the House of Representatives in early January. So it doesn't look like the president will ever get his money for this.
And it sounded fundamentally as a campaign way of having the crowds being into his own campaign.
They would chant about
build the wall, but without being conscious of what it means. The same thing as we will have Mexico pay for it. It's easy to throw a slogan like this in the air. Now he's presenting the USMCA, the new North American Trade Agreement, as a way to pay for the wall because they claim that the USMCA is going to bring so much money in the United States that this money coming from Mexico and probably Canada, because we're part of this too, we were going to tax this to pay the wall. So in the end, it's going to be the Americans paying for the wall.
It's kind of a confused idea, you have to admit.
It's kind of a confused
idea. Right, the president has said in the past week the wall pays for itself. First, if it blocks illegal migration, then you don't have all the cost of arresting them, dealing with them in the court system, locking them up, deporting them. So that would save a lot of money. And in the second way, he claims that the new trade agreement, which is not yet ratified by the legislatures of Mexico, Canada, and the United States, would bring the U.S. so much money that would pay for the wall. And a lot of experts say, huh? How? But it's what the president's saying, because he's saying anything he can to get popular support for the wall idea.
Let me throw one other thing out here. It's interesting that, of course, just a month ago we had this midterm elections and the Republicans, at least on the House side, took quite a beating. Now, looking ahead to 2020, there are a lot of Republicans, particularly in places that the Democrats won in this year and in 2016, who are saying, you know, look, President Trump looks vulnerable here. I'm not going to stick my neck out for him on something like this that most Americans oppose anyway. So in other words, even Republicans in the Senate who are up in 2020 say, look, the president might be vulnerable here. I'm not going to support him on this issue. Is that a reasonable suggestion?
Yeah, we'll probably see more of that. The decision to pull all the U.S. troops out of Syria made a lot of Republicans speak out against a Trump decision. So, yes, it could be a new trend. But I still have to say that when President Trump has an idea that everyone can get around, you still see remarkable bipartisanship and consensus. Not often. But, right, we want to talk about also this criminal justice reform. I mean, that is being approved overwhelmingly, and that comes out of the Trump White House as well. So I wouldn't want people to get the impression that everything Trump does leads to trouble and dissension. Not everything.
Well, on that point, the criminal justice reform, as you say, that is a really, it's a big deal, something that has brought people on really all ends of the spectrum together. Criminal justice reform in this country. It's just criminals in the federal prison system, of
which
course,
is about one-tenth.
Yeah, which is actually a small number of people. But still, sort of the bipartisan aspect of this, though, is it's kind of encouraging.
Yes, it is encouraging. And also the real concrete impact could reach 50,000 people actually in jail. So it's real
they can,
human.
They can be let out early, is that
exactly.
Right?
Real human beings are going to benefit from this. And it's very interesting to see the way it progressed, because the president himself was elected on a tough on crime platform. He was not in favor of this. Jeff Sessions, his attorney general, was against the idea too. And we have to acknowledge the work of Jared Kushner.
His son-in-law,
who's taking this to the end and working hard on this, and then having the support of Democrats and slowly Republicans, and getting to a place where everybody felt comfortable. And now you hear the Republicans in Congress who don't support the bill are isolated and are perceived as extreme.
So, Dan, your suggestion, which was a good one, that, you know, they can agree on some things like this criminal justice reform. They don't have to fight over everything. The idea that Democrats and Republicans, conservatives and liberals can get some things done other than criminal justice reform, in your judgment, what else can they do?
Well, for a very long time, we've been hearing the word infrastructure, that everybody would like to improve the highways, bridges, tunnels, airports of this country. And there's a real need for that. They're in bad shape. That would create jobs and would improve the United States and how it operates. And yet there hasn't been a big push on that. Early on, President Trump said, I'm a builder. I can push that through. Even Democrats will like it. So I think infrastructure ideas will come up again in the next few months. That could be a subject where we'll see bipartisan support, or it'll be a test as to whether President Trump is losing everybody because both parties will not support infrastructure or really move together on this. So to me, that's the test.
But to come back to, the possibility of a shutdown, the president also said, talking about infrastructure, he said if he doesn't get his wall, he's not going to cooperate on things like infrastructure. So he's really doubling down on this wall, holding hostage, if you will, might be too strong a term, perhaps, things that even both sides can agree on.
Now, the wall was such an important campaign promise, right? And people close to Trump say they're very proud of promises made, promises kept. So the wall is so important that when he writes on Twitter about what he'll do or won't do in order to get the money for the wall, I don't take it that seriously. I think this might be a bit unkind. It's almost a tantrum of anger that is likely to blow over. I don't take it as a policy stand. I will or won't do something. We'll see how the wall issue does first.
In the meantime, however, Dan, I noticed Gallup saying that his approval is more stable than approval for prior presidents, going back to Truman. So he remains around 40% of approval, whatever happens.
Not high, not a majority.
Not a majority, but not going down either. And we keep talking about the hurricane season going far longer than the November 30th usual end. So things keeps happening all over the place. We have the impression of going through a full year. We used to say we go through a full year of news in 1 week. Now it's almost in 1 day. And still, he's criticized. People are leaving his government, his administration. And his approval rating, it remains the same, which is kind of fascinating.
But you can't get reelected in 2020 with only 40% of the votes. If that's what happens, he won't win.
He was elected with 46%, and he has never, I think the closest he's come to that has been about 43 or 44
Of course,
so,
that'll depend, Paul, on who the Democrat is running against him in 2020. Well, please, let's keep up with that story, because we'll have a lot to talk about before that election.
All right. Unfortunately, we'll have to end it right there. Boy, we could talk about this stuff all day long, sure. I think. Our thanks to two of Washington's most prominent journalists, Richard LaTendresse. He's with Canada's TVA Nouvelle, and Dan Raviv of Israeli's I-24 News. Thank you, gentlemen, and Merry Christmas. This program is produced by VOA Current Affairs, our engineer, Justin Thwaites. And I'm Paul Brandis of USA Today and West Wing Reports. Thank you for listening.